Hi there, it's Justine. I don't know whether you've ever been to Paris, but if you ever go, don't be like me and skip out on going to see the Eiffel Tower, because seeing it at a distance just doesn't count. Especially as I just found out that under its gaze lies the Palais de Chaillot, where the UN Declaration of Human Rights was first adopted 70 years ago in 1948. And nearby in the Trocadero Human Rights Plaza, there's a commemorative stone engraved with these words: "Wherever men and women are condemned to live in extreme poverty, human rights are violated. To come together to ensure that these rights be respected is our solemn duty." These are the words of Joseph Rozinski, a French priest who dedicated his life to serving the poor and whose lifelong work led to the establishment of the UN International Day for the Eradication of Poverty, October 17. Father Joseph had himself grown up in an extremely poor family, and he would eventually found a non-profit called ATD Fourth World, which aims to get rid of extreme poverty and one of its most common effects, social exclusion. ATD, if you're wondering, stands for All Together in Dignity. And that's also a fitting motto for the episode we're rebroadcasting this week: Simon's interview with Henry and Jane Corbett, who've been serving an extremely disadvantaged community in Everton, Liverpool, for more than half their lives, and, like Rozinski before them, doing their own bit to eradicate poverty.
We're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart. Well, last year I was in the UK filming for our documentary, For the Love of God, How the Church is Better and Worse Than You Ever Imagined. And we just wrapped up filming in Oxford. We were interviewing people like John Lennox and Alistair McGrath and other luminaries. We had some really great conversations there about the influence of Christianity on the West. And, you know, it's Oxford, it's grand, it's impressive, the oldest university in the English-speaking world, and all of that. And as a documentary team, we were feeling pretty good about this. But as we sat down to have breakfast with the couple who'd been hosting us in Oxford, and we're telling them about the documentary and what we'd been doing, they started to tell us about who we really should be interviewing. Now, if you want to see some solid evidence of how the church is better than you ever imagined, they said, you should go to Everton in Liverpool, and you should speak to Henry and Jane Corbett. Now, I was intrigued by this unlikely story. And it's almost like a reverse rags-to-riches tale of how Henry, who was an Eton-educated man, he actually opened the batting for Eton at Lord's. That'll give you a bit of a feel for this. And yes, that is the school that Prince William and Prince Harry went to. How Henry had ended up in a place called Shrewsbury House. This is a youth centre in one of the roughest parts of the lowest-ranking ward in the most deprived local authority in England. This is where Henry met his wife, Jane, and they decided to stay there. They have now both committed more than half their lives to working with the people there, building up the community, trying to reduce poverty in one of the most disadvantaged areas of the UK. And the striking thing is, they're loving it. We had a pretty tight filming schedule, and to be honest, I'm not usually one to divert from the planned path, but as they kept talking to us about the Corbetts, I got a sense that we really needed to talk to them, and I just really wanted to meet them. So we're driving up the freeway towards Liverpool for another scheduled interview, and I put in a call to Henry Corbett. He'd never heard of me, but I had a quick chat to him, and he said, look, if you can get here by 4 o'clock, I'll put the kettle on and we'll see what happens. We got there by four, and by there I mean Shrewsbury House. The locals call it the Shoesy. Henry put the kettle on and we started talking, first of all, about how he became a Christian.
Yeah, I was born in the 50s, growing up in the 60s, so as a teenager I thought science had the answers and I wanted to be a reasonable human being. And I thought Christianity was a sort of nice idea but wishful thinking. And I went to Kenya for a year to help out teaching in a local school. And I remember it was a Christian organisation. I said, I'm sympathetic but agnostic. Went up to university and a guy called David Shepherd was speaking on a Sunday evening, and as far as I was concerned, he was a cricketer for England who'd made 100 against Australia, and I'd listened to it on my little transistor radio. So I went to hear him, and I remember coming out of that thinking, I will give Christianity one last look. And then when I've shown that it doesn't actually make sense, because it's a bit unlikely, I'll look at Buddhism or maybe other things and you know, to be a reasonable human being. I was reading classics, so I began to look at the person of Jesus of Nazareth, and I certainly didn't believe it all, but the more I looked at him, the more I thought just to say he's a good guy didn't quite fit the evidence. And I had lots of discussions and debates, and someone challenged me to go away and write down all my objections. And as I wrote them down, I began to think, actually, I've got answers for these, and I'd need more faith to stay as an atheist than to become a Christian. So I was a reluctant Christian, really. I remember praying a prayer and saying, I'll tell you at 90 whether that means anything. And then beginning to join in with Christians. I wasn't too sure about that either, but met a local church, and the vicar did preach pretty interesting stuff. So it went on from there, really.
And you, having done that, and you went into the ministry, and you've been here in Everton working among disadvantaged people and youth for many years now. Tell me what drew you into the kind of place and work that you've done.
What brought me to Everton in inner city Liverpool was a place called Shrewsbury House, where we are now. And someone said that would be an interesting place to go and have a year before I got trained to be a vicar. So I came up to Liverpool. My mother's a Scot, so I knew Glasgow a bit. So Liverpool, and I love my football. So the thought of Anfield 15 minutes away, Goodison Park 20 minutes away. So I came for a year here and loved it, really, and saw a church that was involved in the community, and the Shoesy has a Christian basis, and I really enjoyed that. And the vicar here then said, after you've trained for 2 years at Theological College, do you want to come back as curate? And I said, I'd love to. So I came back in the late 70s. I'd met my wife now, Jane, and she'd been helping out in that same year. So we got married, lived in a tower block in Everton, then moved to the edge of an estate. And then when the vicar left, Jane and I moved into the vicarage here. So we're quite unusual. We've been in Everton all my ordained ministry. But I love it because it's down to earth. It challenges my faith.
I just want to take you back a bit here to when Henry said they lived in a tower block in Everton. Now, these tower blocks are pretty significant in Everton's history. From the late 1800s right through to around the 1960s, Everton had become one of the most densely populated working-class areas in Britain. So in the 60s, there was a mass clearing of large slum areas. These high-rise blocks were built, and it was this dramatic change to the Everton skyline and to the community. A couple of decades later, many of these high-rise blocks would be demolished for the construction of a park, radically changing the neighbourhood again. But we'll get to that a bit later. Now, for Henry and Jane, living in these tower blocks is a pretty significant part of their story. It's the reason why Jane got into politics.
I remember when we lived in the tower block, we were on the 14th floor, and we had 3 fires in a fortnight, and we couldn't get out. So we said to the fire guys, you know, how would we have got out? And he said, oh, well, you know, the ladders reached the 9th floor. And we went, yeah, we're on the 14th. They went, well, helicopters. So a whole gang of us got together in the block, and we went down to the local housing office. And there was, I can still remember it, there was a grill, and we had to speak through the grill. So there was about 20 of us from the block. And a woman behind the grill almost looked at us sideways as if to say, what's the problem? And it was the first time I'd seen, because I'm not from Liverpool, I came when I was 17 to help out. It was the first time I'd seen adults being treated so disrespectfully when there was a major issue of injustice. And for that, for me, that was a real sort of light bulb moment. So I've been involved in community politics, community development for a long time. That was in 81.
By the 80s, though, there was talk of tearing the towers down to make room for Everton Park.
I thought, well, hang on, what do local people think about that? You know, it was important to my faith that people should be listened to. And I got to know people in the area. So I would, you know, we did a questionnaire and we said, look, what do you think is the best plan? Is it a great big park? And local people said, it'd be lovely to have a park up at the top of the hill to get our view back, because two tower blocks had blocked it for years. But we need to keep a community. The community here is important. So have a park at the top, but keep the community. And that was 85% of local people saying that. So as a church and as a centre here, we got involved in a campaign to keep some of the housing. And that was really important. But it came from a faith background that says people need to be respected and their wisdom needs to be listened to. And they were very wise. I remember going to the chief planning officer and saying, look, this is what local people are saying. And he quietly said that, you know, there's a lot of wisdom in that.
And you look at people in Everson, we have the most disadvantaged community in Liverpool, but we've got a very, very resilient community that really pulls together, but that is always under pressure. So how can I, as a local politician and I, as a Christian, be involved in that? Should I be involved in that? And the answer is obviously yes. And then it's how you do that. So in my head, I think, okay, God sees everybody as made in God's image, number one. Never judge people and put them in a level of status. That is unchristian and it's unbiblical. Try and bring people together. Listen to what their views are. We've got a thing in our little community where we say we need to get local wisdom on the table. So what is the, so you get local, we were literally round the table. What is the wisdom? Get it onto the table. That should be part of that discussion about policy, about changes, about action. And if you can do it like that, then you're getting, whether it's children having a say, whether it's the local community having a say, and then you're getting this bias that is actually listening much harder to the people most affected. So who is affected by that? We've got to make sure they're listened to.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity, and I'm with Henry and Jane Corbett at Shrewsbury House in Everton, and we're sitting in the Shoesy, as it's called, and this is a place where day in and day out for decades, Henry and Jane, alongside a whole team of people from the Shoesy and the neighbouring St Peter's Church, work tirelessly to help people in need. Now, I want to paint a bit of a picture of this place, and even to get my own head around it, the only thing I knew about Everton before this was the football club. But I looked up a thing called the Index of Multiple Deprivation, and it basically ranks areas of the UK according to categories like income, employment, education, and crime. So as an overall score, Everton, Liverpool is doing better than only 6% of all other areas of England. Now, breaking that down, income deprivation in Everton is only better than 9% of all England. Levels of educational attainment is better than 11% of England. And then there's health. It's better than 0% of England. The health outcomes are worse than any other area in England. But these are just numbers. They don't tell the whole story. Recently, Henry and Jane have been involved in helping some asylum seekers in the area who'd occupied a couple of the local blocks. They were having a hard time, especially with some of the press giving a pretty bad impression of them, that they were troublemakers, that they were on the scrounge, so to speak.
So we went to the local two blocks where the asylum seekers were. Now, some of them didn't have much English, but there was one lad from Iraq whose father had said to him that Christians could be good people. He was from a Muslim family in Iraq, and he'd remembered that. So when this vicar came round with a lovely local guy called Matt and knocked on his door, he welcomed us and we got to know him a bit. And then he rang me up and said, Henry, I want to do your church a favour. And I said, oh, that's really kind. We want to use it as a sanctuary because we're going on hunger strike because we're not being treated at all well in this block, which was true. The landlady was not treating them at all well. They were in effect being bullied. So we gathered around in our back kitchen, and my wife Jane, as a local councillor, got the local MP involved, and we worked to try and see if we could make conditions better. Now, where did that come from? Well, because I'm a Christian, and I think people should be listened to, and I think people should be treated well, and they weren't being treated well. If someone's being bullied, that's not what God wants. So we got in alongside them. Also, I believe in a God who's concerned for truth, and some of the misinterpretations about asylum seekers was not fair. Here was a very thoughtful guy who just wanted to, his brother had been killed by Saddam Hussein. So, you know, we wanted them to get treated better, and also we wanted a bit more truth. So I remember him sitting in here with some of the local kids gathered around, and them asking him, oh, how come you've come here? And he explained about his brother being killed, and you could see the kids learning that he was a genuine guy who just wanted to be safe and was really grateful for a country that allowed him to come.
Asylum seekers aren't the only ones doing it tough in Everton, though. Poverty is a huge problem in the community, and Jane says that she hasn't seen it at these levels since the 1970s. And they're getting targeted by some sections of the media too. One of the main arguments is, why are they on benefits if they're working? But Jane says there are more people who work and are living in poverty than people out of work and poor.
And I was working with a family where the little lad was found by his mum. His mum doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, hasn't got a flat screen television, was found peeling wallpaper off the wall to eat at tea time because they literally haven't got anything to eat. This is, you know, a couple of years ago, and it's still happening now, not to this particular family, but to others. And so I supported them and helped out there. And then I said to the mum, how does your little one cope with the emotion of all this? Does it make him very angry? Is he very depressed about it? How does he get his emotions out? I said, is he any good at drawing or drama? She said, he loves drawing. So I said, would you like to do me some drawings about it? So she had a chat with him and he said, yes, if it helps other kids in Liverpool. So I said, brilliant. I said, what are we going to call you? Because we can't call you by your real name because it's a bit too scary if the, you know, right-wing press are outside your door. He said, I want to be called Jack, like Jack Sparrow. So I said, okay, we'll call you Jack. So he drew me a picture of an empty plate and he said, do you see food? He drew me a picture of, an empty plate that then had Africa and then Liverpool over the top of it. And he said, because I've heard kids in Africa are hungry too. And then he came up with this quote. He was seven at the time. He came up with this quote, and this little kid thought he was worthless. So if you go back to your Christian faith, God is saying, you are really, really important. And I constantly say that and text his mum, because she lives off free text, say, you're a cracking little kid here, Jack, keep going. He thought he was worthless. He came up with this brilliant quote that said, listen to me, you're grown-ups. This is bad. You are being bad unless you do something with a K about it.
Jane uses this quote. She shows pictures of little Jack at conferences and meetings. She uses his story to try to get his message out, to try to make a change. But it must be hard, day in, day out, helping people, listening to people talk about the problems in the community. I can imagine that, at least on some days, it feels like one step forward and about 10 steps back.
We still got a long way to go. We've still got, you know, very high levels of poverty, poor educational attainment, but we've gone much, much better than we have done over the years. And people are strong and they're together. The pressure now on families is greater than I've seen for a very long time. And my worry is that people are going to crash.
So I asked Jane, what would her ideal Everton community look like? What's the dream? What is her community aiming for?
If you've got a much more equal society, I'm not saying flat, I'm saying more equal society, that actually reflects where God wants us to be. And you can track that back to lots of the rules and regulations in the Old Testament. So, for example, you weren't allowed to grow your estate, literally, every 7 years it would be chopped, and every 50 it would go back to what it was before. So it was a constant rebalancing all the time. If people were farmers, they weren't allowed to farm right up to the edge of their field, because if people were out of work and they were struggling to survive, they were allowed to walk along the edges of the field so that they could survive. So you've got a balance, ideally, of a society where the income is less than extreme. It's pretty balanced. You've got really good emotional health. You've got people who can, as well as look out for each other, look out. And you've got people that enjoy life, you know? I mean, our little community, you know, looking on paper, you'll see stats and you'll think, oh my goodness. You know, if you came and lived in our community, people would be talking to you on the street corner. They'd be saying, how are you doing, lad? Do you like it around here? People laugh very quickly. They cry very quickly. There's a lot of sharing. There's difficult times. It's not perfect. But it's sort of, it's heaven on earth. It's that trying to get that heaven on earth and matching that up. And that's what it should look like.
So they keep going, meeting with people, talking with people, helping people, rallying people, making these changes in their community for good. Sometimes they're big, but often they're small, incremental changes.
I think because my faith is very much rooted in the fact that it's true, you know, the sun will come up tomorrow. That is true. There may be clouds, there may be hailstorms, there may be all sorts of stuff, but the sun is coming up. And my faith is based on the fact that Jesus was who he said he was, that he did rise again from the dead. We wouldn't have a Christian church if he hadn't. A Catholic priest, when I first came, lovely guy, Jesuit priest, said one of the great things about Christians is they're willing to fight losing battles. And by that he meant that he'd been in the area for a while and he'd seen local residents trying to make things better. And sometimes officialdom is well defended and they didn't get what they thought was right. And he noticed that the people who kept going were the Christians. And I think that's true, because we keep going not because it's necessarily going to be successful, sometimes it isn't, but because it's the right thing to do, as we understand.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith. If you want to listen to Simon's conversation with Henry and Jane Corbett again, or share it with a friend, go to our website publicchristianity.org or find us on your podcast app. Just type Life and Faith in the search box to find us. Next week.
I got interested in this one several years ago. I was teaching a course in Canada on science and religion. Essentially, the course spent half the semester looking at the historical interactions between science and religion, going back to Galileo and the Scientific Revolution, and then the second half of the course looked at modern ideas of science and religion interaction, including creationism and intelligent design movement. And as I was, and the course was really set up to kind of teach this complexity. Say, look, when we look at the history of science and religion, we see this complexity. We see this complexity thesis through and through. And at least one student came to my office and said, you know, what you're teaching runs against what I'm learning in another class. I said, really? And it had to do with Galileo, the idea that Galileo was actually imprisoned, which is not true. I've heard from another student that Galileo was beheaded. Anyway, these ideas... But these ideas,
it should be easy to check.
Yeah, it should be easy to check. And so these, a number of students were saying, look, what you're teaching is going against what I'm learning in the syllabus of other courses. And I asked, well, what courses are those? And at that time, it was anthropology. So that's actually what got me interested in this. And so eventually, when I had the time, I went back to, and I started looking at anthropology textbooks, modern 21st century anthropology textbooks. And lo and behold, I found significant myths about religion and science history.